Welcome to Night School, taking a stab at the Middle Ages.
A podcast devoted to medieval history and culture, and the occasional bad pun.
I'm Becca, bringing you everything related to medieval religion and church history.
And I'm Claire, talking about medieval literature and history. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're talking about Mevlevi Sufism with Dr. Matthew Lynch. Dr. Lynch is a scholar and educator whose research topics include religious and cultural studies, history, literature, and philosophy. He specializes in Persian medieval mystical traditions and critical Islamic studies. He is currently a visiting assistant professor at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He has also held faculty positions at the University of the South, Bard College, and Guilford College. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Lynch. We're really happy to have you. Becca, do you want to start us off with asking the first question?
Yeah, sure. So Claire and I were really excited to get some more background on Islamic Sufism. So thank you for joining us. We were wondering if you could kind of start off. Obviously, there are many variations within Islamic Sufism, but maybe you could share a bit about what are some of the broad beliefs that kind of unite the different forms, and maybe how these mystical strains of devotion are perceived within Islam at large?
Sure. That's an excellent question. It's probably something you'd have to take the whole class to get the whole answer. But one thing to point out is that there's a sort of broad category of Islamic mysticism, right, that incorporates a variety of different traditions within it. So we have like Shia forms of mysticism called Irfan. We also have what's called Sufism these days, which is a particular form of following the path of God, right? So tasawuf is a technical term for that. So Sufism is sort of underneath that Islamic mystical umbrella. And it also has elements that we might not think of as mystical, and we'll get to that later. I think about more political or social elements, for instance. So when we talk about Sufism and we're trying to think, well, what unites various forms of Sufi thought and practice? In terms of beliefs, we can generally safely say two pretty common beliefs that are not just true for Sufis, but true for most Muslims, if not all Muslims, in terms of belief. And that is summed up in the Muslim Shahada, or a statement of faith. And that is that there is no God but God, right? And that Muhammad is the messenger of God. You sometimes hear Muhammad is his prophet. But there are other prophets in the Muslim tradition. So Muhammad having this sort of special role to play as the messenger, bringing the Quran, the revelation, the word of God, to the people. So most Sufis are from that basic Muslim lineage that traces its origins in Muhammad's revelation of the Quran. From there, things get a bit more complicated. Sufi thought and practice spans the full length of 1,300 years, I guess 1,400 years, since the inception of Islam. And if I had to simplify it, this is actually going to sound a little bit not simple. So just bear with me. So if we're talking about Sufis, we can say generally in terms of the Quran, right, and in terms of the message that Muhammad brought, there's an emphasis on the inner meaning of revelation and an intense engagement with the reality or haq of God. Sufis often look beyond the surface level of the Quran and focus on inward meanings, what they call the batin, instead of the zahir. And this is why we associate it with mysticism, right? As a result, they are sometimes seen as an alternative to legalistic or even fundamental Islam, though the picture is much more complicated when we look closer. There are plenty of Sufis who were also jurists, for instance. So it's not like a dichotomy. It's just an aspect, I would say, in that way. There's also, secondarily, I like to point to an emphasis on ethics and or piety that come out of the understanding that the divine reality not only exists, but that we as human beings are intimately connected to it. And the hadith about this that my students love because I repeat all the time is that God is closer to you than your jugular vein, right? And so from that, there's this understanding that you should act in accordance with that proximity of the divine to you. This can show itself in intense ascetic practices like fasting, but it's not always ascetic practices. And we'll get more into those things in just a second. So there's also ritual practices that seek to connect the Sufi to God. So one of the ways that generally people talk about Sufis is that they're aiming for that divine union. And these ritual practices include something called zikr. It's alternately spelled D-H-I-K-R or Z-I-K-R. If you're looking, if you want to go on YouTube and look up what is that, what does zikr practice look like? And if I always tell the students, just try different parts of the world and you'll see there's a wide variety of zikr practices. Zikr just means remembrance. Remembrance of what? Remembrance of God, yes, but remembrance of your creation as being from God, right? So both of those things are connected. And the zikr, for instance, we're going to talk about the sama or the whirling dervish practice later. There's also the recitation of God's 99 names. And these types of practices are part of the reason that we associate Sufis with ecstatic and mystical activities, though just as often, Sufis also spend time learning from books and teachers in a rather staid setting. And one of the other features that you, that wasn't always the case, but that is more common these days, is that you'll find Sufis follow a guide, like a sheikh or a sheikha, or a peer even, in order to deepen their practices, and that Sufis will belong to large orders that end up becoming socio-political entities unto themselves. And so being a Sufi isn't just always about what you believe, but whom you follow and with whom you practice.
So Rebecca and I did read some parts of your dissertation, which argues that scholars have adopted a narrow definition of Islamic scripture, limiting the term to refer to the Quran in exclusion of other texts, such as the Masnavi and Manavi. So could you tell us a little bit about this epic poem, maybe the date, details about composition, about how it was the transcriptions by some of Rumi's murids, and just kind of what drew your research to it, maybe?
Sure. I'd be glad to. I spent a good bit of time on this topic, as you can imagine. So most people interested in what we might call world religions in the U.S., or even sort of new age stuff, have probably heard of the poet Rumi by now, but they often have a skewed perspective on who he was and what he did due to the fact that his biography has largely been separated from his works in popular culture. But he was an influential Muslim teacher of the 13th century. He was born in Central Asia in the Afghan Tajikistan area, and then emigrated to Anatolia, or the Asian part of Turkey, sort of to this town called Konya, as a teenager. And his father was also a Muslim teacher, and Rumi followed in his father's footsteps. He learned all the traditional Muslim sciences. He learned law, he learned logic, philosophy, these sorts of things, as well as hadith traditions. All sorts of things related to what Muhammad said, in addition to interpreting the Quran, right? And he became an expert as well in Sufi teachings, as well as Persian poetry. And so when he led his community, when he led his community of followers, those murids that you talked about, it wasn't as a poet, right, as we sometimes understand him today, but as a master Muslim teacher, right? So he was top level Muslim teacher. And this is why he's called Molana or Mevlana in Persian and Turkish, respectively. And that's also how we get the term Mevlevi, which is from the order that was founded after he passed away. So his primary teaching text is called the Masnavi and Matnavi. So the Masnavi is actually a genre of poetry consisting of lengthy couplet-based verse in specific metrical formation. So there's no breaking the rules here. And sometimes Rumi played with the rules a little bit, but for the most part, his verse was in a pretty structured space, which is why translations don't always get at what's going on in the original, right? And he wasn't the first to write in this genre. He was, in fact, influenced by authors like Attar and Sana'i. Attar has a very famous poem, epic poem called The Conference of the Birds. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. One account, so getting back to when he wrote it, he actually wrote it towards the end of his life. So his reputation as a scholar, poet, teacher was pretty well established. He had a good group of followers, and he was apparently well known even in his time in that part of the world. And his followers came to him and asked him to write a Masnavi, right? And so what did he do? First he pulled the first 18 lines out of his turban, and that's the very famous poem called The Song of the Reed. But he also, around 1256 or so, this happened, maybe 1258, depending on who you ask, he started composing this, and by composing, we sometimes say he wrote it. He actually recited it to a follower named Hossam al-Din, who wrote it down. So around 1256, his followers asked him to write it. He composed it over the course of the next 15 years or so before he passed away in 1273 of the Common Era. And the book itself is remarkably long. It's about 25,000 paired couplets that span across six volumes. Just as a point of comparison, I think if you add the Iliad and the Odyssey together, it's about that length, right, of 25,000 lines. So just to think, and this is over six volumes, so not every volume is of the same length, and he wrote it over that 15 years. And it contains what the text itself calls the roots of the roots of the roots of the religion. And so it's rather deep in its ambitions. The structure is rather interesting. It's primarily stories and short homilies about those stories. It's often told in a sort of disjointed fashion where one story begins before the previous one finishes. This can be either fun or infuriating, depending on the type of reader you are. And then the previous story will come back and finish almost out of nowhere, right? And you'll be, oh, I remember that story now. And then he finishes it, right? A lot of the narratives in the Masnavi are drawn from the Quran, but there's also a ton of stories from folk traditions that predate the Quran or aren't even related to Islam at all. I can talk about what the text communicates a little bit, but again, since it's so long, there's so much in there that to simplify it would be to do it an injustice. But I'll talk about a couple key things that are takeaways from it. One of the key messages in the text is the imperfection of human understanding in relation to God's perfection. And human imperfection actually stems from separation from God, right? And so the Song of the Reed is the song of the separation, of this separation that starts the book. And so in order to perfect your understanding and to perfect yourself, you need to seek union with God. And that, sometimes people say, is the goal of the Sufi path, is to seek union with God. The only thing about that union is that it sometimes means the annihilation of yourself, right? And so that self that we refer to is like a lower self. It's called the nafs. So this is the part of yourself that is lustful, hungry, arrogant, all sorts of things. And so Rumi will take you through, or the text itself, depending on how you want to say it, will take you through different instances of people progressing along the path and try to give sort of lessons on how to do that. He also puts a great emphasis on love and compassion. And I think that emphasis is what makes these poems resonate across time and even in other contexts. There's a lot about, the love of someone else is actually an expression of your love of God and God's love for you. And so there's this sort of interesting, he can tell a story about a romance and then somehow make it some sort of message about the divine. So basically the book was written down by his main disciple, as I said, Hossam al-Din. That disciple then passed it on to the other ones, and they republished it. They wrote down their own, not their own version, but they just rescribed it. And then it sort of spread in that way of just sort of the scribal tradition. And it became so famous that now it's simply called the Masnavi, right? So you don't even need to say the second half and people know what you're talking about. And it's considered the pinnacle of the genre by some people. Some people even have referred to it as the Persian Quran, and that is where the genesis of my writing on it sort of stems from, is a sense of what does it mean to call it that, and why did people call it that?
I guess kind of picking up on how you had mentioned some of them are narratives from the Quran and, you know, the words of Muhammad. So I guess we were also wondering, you know, how you write about that the stories within the Masnavi add dimension and depth at the same time that they cite and meditate on their source. So could you talk a little bit more about kind of how these qualities tie into your argument and your work in your dissertation on why you think the Masnavi should be considered part of the Islamic scriptural tradition?
Sure. So it's kind of a nuanced point I'm trying to make in that I'm not necessarily arguing for instance, Muslims should consider it their scripture, right? This is a question about how do we do religious studies and how do we sort of engage with our materials? And so it's a sort of nuanced point. But my explanation of why I think the text itself could be considered scripture is in two aspects. One is what the text says about itself, and two is how the text is used. So in terms of how the text talks about itself, we already talked about it calling itself the roots of the roots of the roots of the religion, and other and the unveiler of divine mysteries is another thing it calls itself. And it implies in the book itself, there's actually quotes where someone criticizes it, and the text will say, this is what they did to the Quran, right? So the text itself is making comparisons between itself and the Quran. It never explicitly says, I'm a scripture, right? Or something like that. But if you look at the way that the discourse functions, I think there's some sense that this isn't just an ordinary book, right? And its aims are greater than that. And then its usage continuing from there is definitely something that needs much more research, right? So it's sort of, I was kind of indicating a direction of research with a certain framework in mind that if we thought of it that way, how would it change the way we see it being used? And this is sort of what we do in religious studies, right? We want to go back at our categories. We want to sort of destabilize them and sort of see how would that change if we sort of posited a different definition or a different sort of set of materials. So as I said, the book has this language of what I call self-authentication. And you can find this in other scriptures. The Quran, for instance, self-authenticates. It tells you that it is the final and true revelation of God, right? We can find it in other, if we wanted to go into comparative religion, for instance, we can find it in other texts that we already recognize as scriptures, right? So we can find that, and we find the authorial voice self-authenticating in a variety of texts. What I found odd was that despite this language and despite the text's widespread use in a variety of ritual and teaching settings over several centuries, the Masnavi was generally understood by its European translators as a work of religious poetry, like Dante or Chaucer, but Muslim, right? That was their sort of comparison. If it's poetry, it's got to be literature, right? Now, so there's a big argument to be had here about how these categories, largely influenced by Protestantism, helps shape our understanding of other religions. This is something within religious studies that we talk about quite a bit. Even the term religion comes out of the Christian tradition. And so what does it mean to apply that to other, what would we even call them, right? So this, suffice it to say here, that this understanding of what lived religion was like after the appearance of the Masnavi within the particular context in which it appears has been rather impoverished in European and later American scholarship about the book. And we can use that then to question the way that we've defined Islamic practice, past and present.
That's really interesting. Actually, yesterday I sat in on the Medieval Academy's Zoom about teaching race and racisms in the Middle Ages, and that was one of the points. Oh, cool. But that was one of the points that they were talking about, just how like religious studies could be heroes. But I think it's really important to question the categories and like institutions in place that like define terms. So that's really interesting, and it will bring me into my next question. Sure. So during Rumi's own time, there is evidence that the text was used in ritual settings alongside the Quran. Precisely what were some of these ritual settings, and how was the Masnavi talked about or used alongside the Quran? And could you maybe tell us more about the Mevlevi? Is it Mevlevi order?
Mevlevi, yeah. Sure, I can tell you, I can talk about this all day, and I do.
Great.
So just to start with, one of the things that I did in my research was I set up a sort of digital project where I tried to, utilizing some work of some Iranian scholars who did a concordance of the Quran in the Masnavi, I actually did a count of how many quotations or allusions to the Quran there are within the lines of the text. And I found that it was somewhere around 15% of the Masnavi's 25,000 lines had some relationship, either a quote, translation, or allusion to the Quran within. And so that's it. That's huge, right? I need to compare it to some other texts to see, you know, whether there are more or less. And so, for instance, in Hafez or in Attar. But I tend to think that this relationship between the two was not accidental, that this was something that that was part of the intention of, if not intention, it was part of the manifestation of the text. And so I come at the book with that sort of already in mind, that it was doing something with the Quran. Some people just say, oh, it's just exegesis. It's just an interpretation of the Quran. It's not in any way an embodiment, right? And to me, there's some deeper relationship going on than just explanation or interpretation. There's some sort of deployment. There's some sort of performance going on with this extensive use of the Quran within the text. So that's, you can read about that in my dissertation when it finally, I get it all, you know, edited or published or whatever I need to do by January. But that'll be out soon. So that explanation of those two, will be out hopefully soon. From there, right, as I said, it's not just what's in the text, it's what people do with the text. And that's what I think you were more asking about. So one of the key ritual settings, and again, ritual is a problematic word. I don't want to reify ritual. I'm just talking about some form of general practice of human people related. It could be communal worship, attempts at communication with the divine. So one of these key ritual settings when we're talking about Sufis is called the Sema ceremony, or Sema. You sometimes see Sema in Turkish, Sema in sort of the sense that it was used at this time. So early on, this was not a standardized ceremony. There's actually a lot of debate about what the origin of it is. Is it Islamic in origin? Is it Central Asian in origin? Right? Where does this ceremony come from? But the Sema ceremony, was, according to Rumi's hagiographers, or the sort of people who wrote biographies of his life that weren't necessarily interested in objective historical fact and more interested in the sort of characteristics and teachings of the teachers. So in these hagiographers, the Sema ceremonies could happen spontaneously when Rumi was alive. So someone, Rumi himself might be, for instance, reciting some of the verses from the Masnavi or from one of his poems, other poems. And in that recitation, maybe even the Quran appeared to come out of his mouth. And then all of a sudden, he would go into this rapturous state. And these states are called hal in Sufism, H-A-L. If you want to look more into sort of the path of Sufism, it's a path through these states and stations, right? So hal, and that would lead to an outbreak of, sorry to use that word, spinning recitation and experience of the loss of self amongst him and whoever was in the room. And so sometimes people would show up at Rumi's house And they'd already be in this ceremony. They'd already be spinning. They'd already be rending their clothes, according to some accounts. Sometimes it would be something as simple as the smell of the roses would set them off into this. And the sense is that this loss of self that they felt in that moment was a sort of experience of the divine reality within that space, right? Now, what happens is, those of us who read Weber or somebody like that, this practice becomes routinized, standardized, and institutionalized, right? This sama practice. And the practice itself could be planned. For instance, they would have a reading from the Masnavi, and then everyone would know once the reading was over, it was time to dance, right? And it's a really fun dance to watch. You can see it, but it seems like in the early period, it was kind of chaotic. And nowadays it's pretty standard, right? So the role of the Masnavi reciter would be the person within those ritual spaces who knew the Masnavi best, knew best how to read it. And then that would lead to deeper forms of ritual, right, from there. The people who performed this first, the people who participated in this first, came to be known as Mevlevis. That's someone who follows Molana, or our teacher, or Mevlana in Turkish. Mevlevi are the people who follow him. He didn't seem to want to have an order. That wasn't his instruction. He also told them that he didn't want a shrine built. But if you go to Konya, you'll see a really beautiful shrine with a blue dome. And so after his death, though, he was so influential, so famous, and so sort of key to this group that they built the shrine. And also these ceremonies became a little bit more standardized. And through time, then sometime about two centuries later, it seems like it's got a formal structure. You have to do it this way, right? And it's got formal teachers and formal practitioners that have to be initiated into the order and have tons of practice before they're allowed to even do it. So I hope that answers your question. I kind of went off on the Sama ceremony a little bit there. It's kind of a fun thing to study.
No, that was really interesting. And I feel like our listeners will enjoy that little, so.
Definitely. I guess kind of continuing with the conversation of Sama, I had taken a class called Women in Mysticism, and we had talked a little bit about Qawwali music, which I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's more of coming from a context of India and Pakistan, like another version of Sama. But we had talked a bit about how that form of music in this context was, as it became popularized, it was kind of commercialized in or seen as kind of secular. So I guess I was wondering, in the Mevlevi context, is this something that we see where, as it's becoming standardized or as it's becoming, I guess, more accessible for people to witness in person or things like that, have views of Sama changed at all in this context? Or if you could just speak to that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. Qawwali music, if you want to hear some good Qawwali music, you can just go to Koch Studios on YouTube, and there's some, basically Koch decided to sponsor a bunch of famous musicians in Pakistan to perform pop versions of traditional music. So it's an interesting phenomena, certainly gets into these questions of commodification of the sacred, right, that you're bringing up. And it is a really good question, especially in terms of the Mevlevis and this prayer ceremony. As I was talking about routinization, right, that it becomes sort of the standard practice, it has a certain dress associated with it. The idea, though, that it wasn't somehow part of Mevlevi marketing, I think is an interesting one to try to consider, right, that maybe this ceremony was kind of popular and that actually drew people in. But if we're talking about in terms of modernity and something becoming commodified, that's sort of a different process, right? So I never want to take out that sort of social or economic component and say that there was a pure form and then it became polluted. That's a sort of arc that we're trying to get out of, I think. But yeah, I just thought of that because you brought up the Koch Studios thing. Anyway, so the significance of the prayer ceremony As a starting point, as I said, it seemed like that the dervishes were spinning in order to lose themselves and achieve unity with the divine. But at this point in time, where we are now, it's clearly serving larger social and economic functions. So when I was in Konya, where Rumi spent most of his life, there's a convention center, and you can buy tickets to see large performances of it. So like you buy tickets to a basketball game, you can buy tickets to a whirling dervish ceremony, right? And this is people's jobs, is to perform this for tourists. Some people call it like a Disneyfication of the whirling ceremony. I don't know if that's accurate, but I've heard that critique before. Part of the reason that it's been commodified or been performed commercially is that it was actually banned by Ataturk as a form of Sufi or mystical practice. He wanted to get a lot of those things out of Turkish society so that Turkish society would modernize and not be quote unquote superstitious, for instance. That was one thing. Also, Sufis had a lot of power in society at that time. So this is Ataturk trying to break some of the control of these groups on society. And so he flat out banned this, right? And so for a long time, the only way it could be performed was as a cultural practice, right? Was as a performance of a dance and not as a religious ceremony. Did people still do it? Do people still do it now as a ritual? Of course. They did it behind closed doors, and they generally wouldn't advertise that that was going on. In recent years, I think the slippage is pretty much complete, where the secularization of Turkey isn't really as much a question, but the status of Sufis still is, right? So it's an interesting situation, I guess I'd say. It spread into a worldwide practice. It influenced other groups' ritual practice, right? So some people may not call it the whirling dervish dance or do similar versions of it. And so it's sort of the cat got out of the bag at some point. So how it's affected views of the Sama, certainly this commercialization seems like a dilution if you were asking somebody who was a practitioner, right? But some practitioners say you just need to look beyond the external. Remember, like I said, look beyond the external form and look for the inward form. The inward form is still there, right? So that's what you would be attentive to. I think that kind of gets at the Sama ceremony. Again, I'm not an expert on dance. I honestly couldn't even do it if you asked me to without falling down. It's a precise dance of spinning that has really specific movements allowing you to stay spinning for hours at a time. So I'd recommend just looking more into it if you are a fan of dance and sort of seeing how it does make you feel. It's not just a matter of believing that it's bringing you to divine reality. There's something physically that happens to you when you spin that much, right? So it's a way of getting physically into that ecstatic space as much as it is some sort of representation of a belief in ecstatic space.
That's really interesting. Now I want to go look it up. Maybe we can post something on our Twitter about more information, because we like to add some audio, visual stuff with each episode.
It might be interesting to just do a juxtaposition of, so you can find the people doing it in the convention center, and then you could find it sort of in a more intimate ritual setting and sort of let people see that juxtaposition.
Cool. Yeah. Next question. So you talk about how mystical orders often intersect with politics, which I thought was a really interesting part of what I read. So could you describe the nature of this relationship between mysticism and politics, and how is it often wrongly portrayed? And then I do always like to talk about medieval modern connections. So I do also want to ask you, why is acknowledging that foundations of Sufi orders were not apolitical important to fight against anti-Muslim derogatory post 9/11 dualistic conceptions? I know that's a big question, but
I actually really like this question because you sort of brought up the sort of contemporary context of discussions of Sufism and Islam that I think you should never leave out of the room, right? It should always be in there that we are situated in a place, we are situated in a society that's, like, if we're talking about American society, that has been Islamophobic, going well back before 9/11, but certainly it ramped up quite a bit. I started studying Islam after 9/11. I was personally attracted to Sufism because of my perception of its emphasis on beauty and love. Also thinking of cultural traditions, a lot of people only wanted to talk about Islam in terms of political situations or violence. And so I actually tended towards thinking of Sufism in apolitical ways. I think it's a maybe almost too natural tendency, right, to encounter something that is emphasis on beauty and just sticking in that space, right? And that can even be a critique of mystical spaces, right, which is that they insulate themselves from the real problems facing a society. The interesting thing to do is not to project that backwards onto Sufis themselves, right? So I'm going to sort of get into that. The more you study this stuff, you realize that the mystical can never be fully extricated from the political, despite people's desires. Rumi recognized this, and he had many communications with the powers of his time, first the Seljuks, later the vassals of the Mongols. He literally wrote letters to them asking for his followers to get jobs, right? So think of like Rumi writing recommendation letters, right, to the State Department, for instance, would be a comparison. So people need to eat, people need protection, people need jobs. This is true whether it's now or then, right? Sufi leaders know this and often have to get their hands dirty, so to speak. This can mean anything from competing for patronage, right, to shit-talking their opponents, pardon my language, to simply doing outreach to other religious groups like Christians or Jews that were in their area. This is all part of the political negotiations that they would have had to play in order to create a functioning group of followers, right? So that never goes away, right? Despite the emphasis on asceticism or the emphasis on the inward reality as being more important, you still have to go back and live your life at the end of the day. So the big conflict with, just to shift gears here, within Muslim discourse, so intra-Muslim discourse, appears right now to be between, one of the big conflicts is between anti-Sufis and Sufis. And you see this like in Pakistan we were talking about, but also in Egypt and other places, shrines getting destroyed, shrines to famous Sufi saints getting destroyed. You have Sufi leaders sort of being persecuted, for instance, or something like that. And people being persecuted for belonging to Sufi communities because a small minority of Muslims who have an outsized influence, frankly, find them to be polytheistic or too closely aligned with non-Muslim groups like Americans and Europeans, right? So Sufism is very popular in the US and in Europe. And at times, amongst Muslims in Muslim-majority countries, less popular, right? That's just a dynamic that we find right now. So they also, Sufis represent competition over who is the authority in Islam, right? So if we look at, for instance, this book, a great book by Zarina Grewal called Islam is a Foreign Country, she talks about this competition for authority, these multiple centers of authority that occur amongst Muslims worldwide, and how different Muslim practitioners navigate that. And Sufism is implicated in that as well, right? For all the reasons that I've talked about. The only thing to be aware of is that even though the good Sufi, bad Muslim dichotomy might be popular amongst some sort of European, American interlocutors, if you go back, Sufi leaders were often at times the biggest opponents of colonialism and actually led rebellions against European colonial powers. So there's no neat sort of categorization here. It's all pretty messy, and it depends on the situations that you look at.
We kind of just wanted to end on a fun, a more fun and formal question.
Sure.
So we wanted to know if you had any reading recommendations or maybe what's the best thing you read or learned during quarantine?
Sure. So one of my sort of side projects is thinking through Sufism, Islam, and what we might call countercultural movements, or movements that are sort of at the margins of culture that come to be influential. And so I've talked about this in a little bit recently, and I've been trying to sort of do I have a little research project on Islam and hip hop, for instance, right now. And so we're going to talk about Islam and hip hop. This book, you all can see it, but I'll just say it's called Muslim Cool, Race, Religion, and Hip Hop in the United States. It's by Suad Abdul Kabir. And this is an excellent book because she brings together both this notion of blackness and its importance to American society, but also Islam and how it articulates itself within American society. And thinking of that post-war period where the normal forms of governance and society basically seem to fail, how do communities respond and create their own networks of knowledge and of culture? And then how do those influence what we might call mainstream culture from there? So Muslim Cool, definitely a great read. I've also been reading this book called Heads, which is a biography of psychedelic America.
Ooh.
And what the author of this book, Jesse Jarnow, is a great follow on Twitter, especially if you like music. He takes you through how basically countercultural movements in the 60s related to Northern California, the band The Grateful Dead, and people they influenced or were in conversation with actually created a lot of tech culture, right? Which is really bizarre to think about. But like a lot of the early internet pioneers were coming out of this culture of heads. And I think that really dovetails nicely with this discussion of hip hop and its sort of enmeshing in culture. Because now we're in a space where, yeah, technology's everywhere, hip hop's everywhere. How did we get here, right? What's the genealogy? And then the next one I'm going to read is actually this book called Cyber Sufis by Robert Rosenau, Virtual Expressions of the American Muslim Experience. So this idea that religious practice is moving online, has moved almost entirely online for some religious groups, especially Sufi groups that have a very sort of spread out population, but want to be in touch with their spiritual guide, their teacher, and how do you manage that? And I think it couldn't be more relevant to the sort of Zoom life we're living right now. So I'm excited to get started now.
Awesome.
Okay, that's all we have time for, but make sure to tune in next week as we talk about medieval smells with Dr. Holly Dugan.